This is Fresh Air. Evan Handler was on Broadway performing in Neil Simon's Biloxi Blues when he found out he had leukemia. That was 8 years ago. Now he's off Broadway performing a one-man show which he wrote about surviving leukemia and surviving the medical bureaucracy. The show is called Time on Fire, a comedy of terrors. New York Times theater critic Mel Gusso described it as a laceratingly funny and self-revealing show. Gusso described Handler as a fine actor, an equally fine writer, and a consummate reenactor of his own experience. Handler has been on Broadway in the original cast of Six Degrees of Separation, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Broadway Bound, and I Hate Hamlet. Before we talk about his one-man show, let's hear an excerpt from the beginning of Time on Fire.
"I'm afraid it is not good news," is what he said. "It is bad news. It is in the bone marrow. It's an acute myeloid leukemia." Now, for some reason, this doctor, in my memory, has turned into Richard Nixon. If Richard Nixon ever got interested in acting in the movie, I'd give him the part. We were in the doctor's office for some time after that. Me, my parents, and my girlfriend Jackie. There was some talk of intensive chemotherapy, remission rates. The phrase "not curable" hit me from somewhere. I only remember that I kept rubbing the side of my face really hard. "Okay, okay, okay," I finally said, and everyone seemed a little bit startled, as if they'd forgotten that I was actually there in the room with them. "I have to get out of here now. We can talk about all this later," and I got up to go. "I wouldn't wait very long," Dr. Nixon said, and we stumbled out of his office and into the street. At 8 a.m. the next morning, I became patient number 865770. We'd pulled some strings to get me admitted to a world-class treatment center right away, but we were totally unprepared for the bureaucratic hell that would greet us when we checked in. I guess I had a vision of something like traffic being stopped on 68th Street so the kid with cancer could pass. At least I expected to be treated as someone who was in great emotional pain and about to undergo great physical pain as well. And that's exactly how I was to be treated. New York style. We were herded along with hordes of others to an admitting waiting room on the first floor. We waited for an hour and a half before my name was called, and I was directed to sit in a cubicle with a very thin young woman. There was a lipstick-stained cigarette burning in an ashtray on her desk. The woman immediately began firing ridiculously mundane questions at me in a heavily accented mumble without ever making eye contact once. I thought to myself, oh, of course, of course. These people train at the same school as the token booth clerks. Then the woman said something to me that sounded like, "Make a buck up to X-ray, push a dove in a smocker, and wait for a technician." She pulled a form from her typewriter, handed it to me, and reloaded, all without looking up. After typing several more lines, she stopped and looked over at me for the first time. Once I had her attention, I was so pleased that a big smile broke out across my face. She was quite pretty when she wasn't scowling. Now she was just staring at me blankly. I said, "Thank you." She sat looking at me like a cow looks at you when you say moo.
That's Evan Handler performing an excerpt of his show Time on Fire. When you got sick, you were starring in Neil Simon's Biloxi Blues. One of my favorite moments is when one of your doctors says to you, "Oh, I don't really care for Neil Simon myself."
Yeah, that was my first doctor. He was a pip.
And then a nurse says to you, upon hearing that you're an actor, "Oh, Johnny Cazale died on the first floor of the hospital."
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He played Fredo in The Godfather, for our listeners who don't remember him.
Yeah, he was also great in Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, so this must have made you feel great.
the first hospital that I was at was a really cold-hearted place, generally speaking. There were some good people there, but it was a major institution in New York City, which I guess is one of our colder-hearted cities in general. But I found an astonishing amount of real insensitivity. And that's a lot of what the piece is about. I mean, I like to say that the piece is, anybody who's ever wanted to get back at a doctor would have a good time listening to the piece. I guess the excerpt gives you a little of that. Just the assembly line kind of thing.
The hospital, when you walk into a hospital, you really do feel like you've been transported to another world, a world with a big bureaucracy and a lot of pain. What did it get to you when you'd hear people screaming as you were waiting for a treatment or, you know, walking through the halls?
Sure, it's horrifying. I still find it horrifying. I go sometimes for checkups in different places in the next little cubicle. I think, as with a lot of systems and bureaucracies, a lot of just the way of doling out the care, the way the examination rooms are set up, those systems were formed a long time ago, before a lot of thought was given, and people realized just how important certain emotional aspects and mindsets are to recovery. I get in a lot of that in the piece as well. There's a passage about the notion of false hope, and how many times I heard doctors and nurses talking about avoiding false hope, which is, you know, a phrase that I personally find, I mean, I don't know that it exists.
I mean, what's the point of hope?
Semi-private to me.
Right.
You know, I mean, something's either private or not.
Right.
I think it's an oxymoron. I don't think the term hope has any connotations of certainty or absolutism. It's a desire. It's a longing. And I think that you should cultivate those desires and build on the energy of those desires. And I don't think that necessarily has to do with giving up the realistic notion that the desire may not be achieved. But to discourage people from hoping, I think, is a mistake. And I think it tends to generally protect the caregiver more than the patient. I think it protects the caregiver from having to deal with possibly the patient's failure to achieve their goal.
How did you tell your colleagues in Biloxi Blues that you were sick after you got your diagnosis?
I didn't. I was just not feeling well, and I didn't go to rehearsals for a while. And when, over the course of a week or so, I found out what the problem was, I just had my agent contact the producers, who were wonderful about it. There was a lot of, you know, care and support sent my way, but I just kind of vanished from the world for a few years, is what happened. Intermittently, I mean, I came back, then I'd disappear again. And a lot of the piece, again, is written as an explanation of where people go when they disappear because of a health issue, because it's like you said, it is another world that is not visible as you walk down the street. I mean, now if I walk in certain neighborhoods of Manhattan near the hospitals that I was in, I think, oh, there's this whole society inside that building that no one on the outside is aware of.
Actor Evan Handler is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Evan Handler. He's doing a one-man show that he wrote based on his experiences when he had leukemia. When you have a bone marrow transplant, as mm-hmm. you did, you get the bone marrow usually from people in your family who have similar bone marrow makeup?
Yeah, I'll get awfully technical on you here. I'm kind of a lay doctor. But
yeah.
There are different types of bone marrow transplants. I had one called an autologous bone marrow transplant, meaning that the leukemia cells in my blood and bone marrow happened to be extremely reactive to chemotherapy, and I didn't have a direct genetic match of a relative. So they removed bone marrow from my body during a complete remission, treated it with chemotherapy drugs outside my body, then killed off all the bone marrow left inside my body with what they call super lethal doses of chemotherapy, and gave me back the bone marrow they had taken out, like a blood transfusion. And the little bone marrow cells know to travel through the bloodstream back into the bones to lodge there and to begin to reproduce. And the theory behind it is that they treat the marrow so hard that only the healthiest cells will survive and begin to repopulate the bone marrow.
How much did you want to know about all the procedures being done to you?
it became necessary for me to know everything. I mean, that was my philosophy. A lot of different people have different feelings about it. I guess I've become kind of militant. I mean, when I hear about doctors and families who choose for the patients not to inform them about certain things, I go kind of haywire. Personally, I'm a believer in information is power. And once you learn how to take control of a situation, you're in a better situation to make the best decisions for yourself. So that became necessary for me. And I think it became necessary really quickly because of the center that I was first treated at. Because their priorities were to keep their system functioning smoothly. And it became clear very quickly that there were a number of drugs that I would react badly to. And you had to practically fight physically to keep from being medicated with the wrong drugs because it required special attention, it required extra time and care being given. And, you know, I found in a number of hospitals, not all, but a quick recovery or a quick death is the most expedient solution. That, you know, really personalized care becomes a big drain on the resources of the hospital.
There was a rabbi who came in and visited you when you got really sick. Did you say to him, and by the way, Rabbi, I co-starred in the film version of The Chosen.
No, I don't know if I did. I think I pretty much...
You're too sick.
I know with the doctors, I pulled out any trump card I could use to kind of get their attention and any special treatment I could. The rabbis were pretty eager for customers. You know, all the clergy in the hospital were tromping up and down the halls and offering their services. I don't come from a religious family. I basically, the one thing that got me that's also in the piece about the rabbis was there's apparently a ceremony in the Jewish religion having to do with the Book of Life, where they sometimes rename an individual in a special ceremony in the temple. And with a new name, apparently the angel of death is unable to locate the individual and the life is spared. And that, I thought, was just one of the most marvelous things I had ever heard of. And I agreed right away to that. So that was pretty much my use of religion to get through.
After your first round of chemo, you thought you were in good shape. You went back to acting again. And you were acting in a Neil Simon play, Broadway Bound, mm-hmm. when you relapsed, when you got leukemia again.
Yeah, that's when I started wondering if Neil Simon plays were carcinogenic.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to ask you. I was going to advise you not to perform in his work anymore.
Well, yeah. I'm still hoping to do it again, actually.
Are you really?
Yeah. I'm a gambler.
But, you know, you were talking about false hope before.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me like that's, you know, I've heard from so many people, too many, that the worst thing is when it recurs. And you thought you were over it, and mm-hmm. you've got to deal with it again.
Yeah.
And that's just like the worst thing.
Yeah, well, I sure had a crisis of faith. I mean, I found myself in the hospital the first time, a person who hadn't been trained or brought up with much faith in anything but myself, and had to draw on that the first time, and wondered if that would be enough. So I worked a lot with kind of self-actualization stuff, psychic healers, psychotherapy, anything I could kind of get my hands on, and got through it and convinced myself that this was my path to healing and I would stay well. And when it recurred, I had a tremendous crisis of faith, just the same as if I had to have put my faith in God the first time. And what I found the second time through was I became incredibly bitter and angry, and I used that. I became a person who decided that I was going to survive as a testimonial against all the comforting positive theories that had gotten me through the first time, and what a remarkable thing it would be to survive leukemia with no faith in anything at all. And I used my anger and fury to ride me, any energy I could muster. I didn't believe that it had to be positive at that point.
Well, you know, one always hopes that if one survives a life-threatening experience, let alone two rounds of life-threatening experiences, that your ego will be put in a proper perspective and that you will have transcended certain petty things that we humans are prone to. And certainly, you know, acting is one of the fields where, like, slights to the ego are probably most frequent and oppressive. Did you feel like, well, after what I've survived, I'm transcending all these petty ego things, and if I don't get a role, I can survive that? And did it make a difference?
It has made some difference. It's still a constant struggle for me. I mean, I think actors and actresses and most people in the theater are kind of, I include myself in this, they're all soothing some sort of sickness on their own part. And I know I don't come to it from a particularly healthy place. So, and I'm still susceptible to all that stuff. As I see it now, I have like a little doorway, a little tiny window that when I really need it, I can kind of squeeze through and remember the lessons that I had learned.
Mm-hmm.
But I get really caught up in things. I mean, there's a good friend of mine who, when I was just about to go down to Baltimore for the bone marrow transplant, who I said to him, you know, if I ever get through this, I am never going to worry about anything again. I'm never going to hurry anywhere again. I'm going to sit someplace green, and I'm going to watch the sun go up and down. And about 2 or 3 years later, I met him on a day when I was sweating and frustrated and angry.
Yeah.
And he reminded me of that story. And all I wanted to do was punch him in the face as hard as I could and make him disappear from the world, because he'd shown me how I had failed to live up to what I had sworn. But life catches you up again. So I get completely caught up in life again, while at the same time having a section of myself that is aware that, hey, you can stop this. You don't have to do this. And I do, at times when it gets too overwhelming, pull myself back and say, this isn't worth it. You know, this here we've reached a line. And that's kind of how it is for me. I can only speak for myself.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Evan Handler is performing his one-man show, Time on Fire, through Thursday night in New York. This is Fresh Air.